From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time my guest Alan Bull was here, we talked about his affinity for intergenerational conflicts and how it's run through so much of the work he's done, be it Swing Town or 6 Feet Under or Tales of the City. I think that certainly appends to the second season, and as well as the first season of the adaptation of Tokyo Vice, which is on Max. First of all, Alan, thanks for coming back. I want to get into this thing because it's very much about intergenerational conflict in this show, isn't it?
Yes, it is very much. And it was a time, it's the year 2000 now in season two, and it was a time when there were big shifts going on in Japan between generations, and that applied to the police world, the Yakuza world, the world of the press, and the world of the nightlife, which are our four main spheres. So it was really nice to be able to showcase that more in the second season.
I think, though, it's fascinating because we realize as we're watching a show about a crusading newspaper journalist, which almost makes it feel like a Sam Fuller film in some ways. And there's so many things about it because it's also about this shift in power. Especially if we read the book Tokyo Vice, this shift in power from the older generation of the Yakuza to the younger generation, but still this wall of formality about what needed to be done and didn't need to be done. And then I think in the second season, that generational power struggle is really a big part of the show.
Yeah, it really is. And even in the world of the Yakuza, this was the time, I mean, it actually started in the mid-90s and came to a head around this time of what they called the Interi Yakuza, which means essentially intellectual Yakuza. It was a Japanese, shortening of that. But it was a time when the old world, like Ishida, who referred to themselves as being on the noble path and had a strict set of moral rules.
And codes.
Yes, and codes was being usurped by younger, more professional, more financially savvy groups like the Tozawa gang, who dressed in suits, as we see, the Chihara Kai guys have their white track suits on, and they're always kind of schlumpy looking or it's slightly dated. And Tozawa comes in his spiffy three-piece suits, and they were using modern business tactics to push the older gangs out, but also to insinuate themselves into the higher levels of the Japanese government, which you see as the season unfolds. At the same time, getting very heavily involved in drug trade, which was kind of off limits for the older, more noble gangs, and in particular, meth.
We talk about the generational thing. And this season, we're seeing it too, is about the Yakuza becoming more international and the dangers of that.
Now we're very savvy about triads and Korean gangs. And in Japan at this time, there actually were a series of laws that were passed, and particularly between the time of season two and now, that really significantly restricted what the Yakuza were able to do. Because of their infiltration into government, it became any public figure, any government minister, anybody with a public job, if they were known to have any contact with any member of an organized crime group, they were immediately taken out. And it's even for us, it was a bit of a conundrum because we want to have experts. We want to be authentic and accurate. We want to get the best possible advice. And of course, we had Jake, real Jake, as we call him, Jake Adelstein, who wrote the memoir the show is based on, who is very savvy about Yakuza. But we also needed a more detail-oriented Japanese Yakuza advisor. And we had several, but they had to be proven to be ex-Yakuza. In episode 8, we see Gen Sato's loyal retainer give Sato the letter of excommunication, which is called a hamonjo in Japanese. We had to have our Yakuza experts produce something like that that proved that they had been severed from the gang that they had once been members of, or else we were not allowed to have any official contact with them.
We should say, for those who haven't had a chance to see the show yet, and it's on Max, and the last episode is imminent, Jake is played by Ansel Elgort, who's a crusading, really an old-school muckraking crusading journalist who goes to work in Japan. And there's an arrogance in that I think is kind of fascinating. I've seen this a lot of people who've gone to Japan from America who go there, and because they know the language, immediately think they know the country.
As someone who's spent a lot of time in Japan and I speak the language, I can tell you that it can, no matter how many years there, it can be a humbling experience.
And it's been that for Jake on the show.
It's been that for Jake and a little bit for Ansel, because Ansel himself has learned the language and learned how to fit into the society more, but he still realizes how far there is to go. Jake is a great protagonist because he is completely comfortable with the bull in the china shop role. He doesn't mind breaking things, which is what makes him interesting as a protagonist. But the truth is that in Japan, there are ways you do things and ways you don't, and that there are codes that you have to understand that go beyond just a literal understanding of the language. And we're watching Jake learn that by making mistakes over and over again. And the danger going in of the show being seen as a white savior show, because the protagonist is an American in Japan who is able to publish things or break taboos in a ways that the Japanese cannot. But it's not Last Samurai, because Jake, as the fish out of water, is someone who's already been living in the water for 3 years. So he's kind of like the tour guide character, but one who's already inculcated into the culture. And also, we, of course, stressed that it was an ensemble show and made the characters around him have deep and complex arcs and also personalized that we get much more into in the second season. But we were very aware of not wanting to have it be about American journalist shows them how it should be done.
It's the treatment. My guest, who has been playing one of the actors from The Last Samurai in his show, Tokyo Vice, is Alan Poole. The show is on Max. You can also hear this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But I think what the show is about, and for me, is this thing that you've done before, too, is how somebody can casually destroy the lives of everybody around them while thinking they're doing the right thing. And that's who Jake is. And that, for me, increases the stakes for the ensemble, because by this final episode, we can see how much ruin he's caused. And it's for me, whets my appetite for another season, because you want to see how this world will kind of heal, or can it heal its wounds based on the damage that he's caused, including, like, creating a whole new, we can say, kingpin in the Yakuza.
We did, as opposed to season one, at the end of season two, we did tie things up a lot more, because season one ended with a series of cliffhangers that by the time that we aired season one, we hadn't yet been picked up for season two. And so a lot of people got very angry, but we had faith. I think we still have faith, but our level of faith might have become a little more realistic. So we decided to really provide a satisfying conclusion. But it is, I'm always attracted to shows that are about people with the best of intentions who then screw everything up.
That, and it really comes to the fore, I think in the last three episodes of this season, how much damage he's done. And you were talking about him growing up. He's able to see that damage causes him hurt in a way that he didn't in the first season. It's fascinating by this, the 10th episode, how much of that arrogance has sort of been beaten out of him in some ways.
I mean, we leave him, I don't want to give spoilers, but we do leave him in a place where we're not sure what he's going to do next, and where his colleague slash father-son relationship with Katagiri, the Ken Watanabe character, has an uncertain future. We don't know what road they're going to do, what their relationship is going to be going forward. Things have definitely come to a big turning point. I think Jake, in a sense, ends in a place where he has not triumphed, and yet it's a very strong moment for the character. The character has reached a new level of self-awareness.
I mean, there's so much in this that sort of feels to me like old school Japanese cinema, how still it gets. And I was thinking, and I mentioned this to you in a text, I think, how much I've loved your direction. I was thinking about the end of season one and the beginning of season two, and you directed both those episodes, and starting off in Samantha's apartment with all this sort of chaos around her that really is kind of emblematic of where the show is. And you start off the second season, that episode, with this view, this extraordinary sort of view of the Tokyo skyline that reminds us what a big place this is. And I wanted to talk to you about, because there's intimacy and enormity of scale between those two episodes. And there's such great filmmaking in it, I think.
Thank you very much. We intentionally ended season one with a bunch of cliffhangers, and we knew season two we were going to pick up where we left off, but it was hard to figure out how to get into it, especially because it's been 2 years. Almost since we've been on the air, and yes, you can do previously on and recaps and stuff, but to bring us back into the world. And so we felt we had to have a very long, still moment before we could jump back into the action. And so that's why, together with my DP, Corey Walter, we devised this very complicated shot that appears to be one single shot that I'll, you know, spoiler, it's not actually, but where the shot that begins with beautiful like just after twilight, pan down of the Tokyo skyline, and then a boat enters the frame, and then the boat comes by the camera, and then we swing around to the back of the boat, and we go inside, and we realize it's a pleasure yacht, and maybe a pleasure yacht with some Yakuza connection, and then we move through the yacht, and then we go down a stairwell and into a corridor, and into that corridor come the two guys who had been in the room with Paulina, Samantha's best friend, when she was killed at the end of season one. And then they walk down the corridor and they open a door. And the minute they open the door, we're back into the footage from season one. And we're sitting in Katagiri's living room. And we know that this is Jake showing him the videotape that he received at the end of season one. And it's like, well, we're back. We really wanted it to be able to set up the audience so that they were prepared to jump back in. And so that when they realized where we were, that we were actually back in the middle of where we had left off, that it would be a little bit of a whoa moment. So.
I want to talk to you about your directing, because this chaos we're talking about, this carnage, is that shot of Samantha on her bed and her keys and things laying around her, and her almost not being able to get up from being supine. That to me just sort of felt like such a great sort of emotional state to tell us what was going on in the show in terms of it small rather than over-explaining. Mm. I mean, I really like that opening for that episode 8 of season 1.
Thank you. And in season 2, I mean, one of the great joys of that first episode was being able to work closely with Rachel Keller, who plays Samantha, because the whole episode for her is her dark slide. I mean, she really hits rock bottom. And so taking it, even though she started at a place of not knowing what was going on, not knowing where her friend is who's been gone for a week and she hasn't heard from, and also having had all of her money taken from her by a wayward host. So she's already kind of at bottom, but she still wants to know what happened to Pauline. And of course, we know. So we're tracking her emotional state from trying to get her club open, but also having just had all of her money taken and having to get in bed with the Yakuza. So she's in this very compromised position. And then we watch as in the first third of the episode, Jake has to break the news to her about what happened. And then we see her literally disintegrate until she's sort of lying on the floor of a nightclub, having been knocked over by some dancers. It was a challenge for Rachel because we didn't shoot completely in sequence. And also we had to chart, like, here's where this would happen to you. And here's where you would have completely broken down. And here's how drunk you are. And it's heartrending. So I don't want to say it was a great pleasure, but I really enjoyed being able to track Samantha's dark night of the soul.
Well, we're taking some pleasure and despair with my guest, Alan Poole. We're talking about the show Tokyo Vice, which is enjoying its second season on Max. This is The Treatment, which is enjoying its 26th season on KZRW. There's more to come. Stay with us. It's always a pleasure to have Alan Poole here. It's The Treatment, by the way, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. We're talking about his newest project, the second season of Tokyo Vice on Max. For me, Samantha, who seemed like she was almost like a classic helpmate character, became the soul of the show because we see how much she lost. And we also sort of see, we were reminded of who she was in an exchange she has with Jake about where they are now, that I don't want to give away because it's my favorite line, my favorite exchange in the entire series.
Don't spoil it completely. But the nice thing is because she and Jake have had a kind of a rocky history and it explodes in the first episode of season 2. But 3 months later, by the time we get to episode 2, we had to establish that they've been able to become friends again, which means that she's gotten past the trauma of Paulina and the fact that she kind of castigated him for having brought her the news, hoping to get a quote to put in a story. And also that there was a kind of romantic push and pull going on between them in first season, which kind of culminated in this crazy scene in the season finale where they're high on meth and they suddenly start having sex and then break out laughing and stop. But so it's reestablish them on a new level so that they could be best friends and not have that level of conflict meant that they could also help each other.
But again, for me, because I feel like she's in some ways the soul of the show, she sacrificed herself on the altar of friendship, as has Katagiri. After so many people wanting to help this person who wants to use journalism and for what it was created for, to expose the truth and to force people to look at themselves. But there's also almost kind of an old school, like, newspaperman romantic comedy thing, like the front page thing to him about, he's so, I don't want to say it's the narcissist, but certainly self-involved enough that there's something both funny and tragic about that character to me.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't say narcissist, but Jake...
I didn't either, that's why I stopped myself.
it's a whole other world I don't want to get into. But you know, Jake is capable of sacrifice, and he is capable of nobility. In fact, he really tries to help Sam in terms of this whole, it's a little bit convoluted, but this scheme that she was putting together with the architect, you know, who then met a very quick and sad ending. And she asks him, you know, can't you help me by publishing a story? And she enlists him to help her, to get her out of trouble. So I think Jake is very much capable of the noble gesture, especially in season two. He's, you know, there's a little bit of like, I'm a scorpion. Yeah, he can't help who he is.
That's the thing that's both funny and tragic.
He's much more aware of it. And I think he fights it more. And I think he makes significant gains. And in Jake's moral trajectory moving forward, assuming that we do get a third season, there's nowhere to go but up.
I want to ask you about shaping the show in that way, because each season has been about people coming to realizations, the final episode of each season. And I wonder if that's something that you thought out before you guys started to work on the show, or if it's something that just happened in the writing in both cases.
Well, I think that season two was definitely conceived to push every one of our main characters to a place where they almost didn't recognize themselves, and to push them to the point where they had to have some kind of realization, and to test the boundaries of what they were willing to do and force them to make some morally questionable choices in order to achieve a goal. And that holds for Jake, Katagiri, Samantha, Nagata, the new police lieutenant who's above Katagiri, Sato, of course, and Emmy, of course. But, I mean, and I have to toss this to JT Rogers, who's our writer, showrunner, creator of the series, is that JT is interested in moral questions. He's interested in history. He's interested in the conflict of the choices involved in self-realization. And he's much less interested, at least superficially, in bang, bang, kiss, kiss, or kiss, kiss, bang, bang. I guess I should get it right. It's part of the benefit of JT, by his own admission, says this is a genre show written by somebody who never had any intention to write a genre show. So he's always, we always make sure that we have the set pieces, we have the violence, we have the twists and turns and reveals, but he's really more interested in the micro moments of a character having to realize something.
It's the truth. My guess who's quoting both Italian cinema and Pauline Kael is Alan Poole. The show in which he runs with J.T. Rogers is Tokyo Vice on Max. You can also hear The Treatment at kcrw.com/The Treatment. We're talking about Katagiri. And first of all, that's the greatest car on any TV show of the last 10 years.
We had two of them. We had to.
Where did you find them?
Well, there's a whole thing about picture cars in Japan, which is that people don't keep old things in Japan. I mean, antiques, yes, but in terms of the modern era,
there's no room.
There's no room. There's no landmarking of any buildings except for pre-modern buildings. Things just get, like, incredible pieces of architecture get torn down all the time. And so similarly with old cars, there's no culture of riding around in old junkers or, you know, refurbishing a car. But we found the one. It's a Fair Lady Z, Nissan Fair Lady Z. The real life model for Katagiri's character, meaning real Jake's actual police mentor, drove muscle cars. And it was one of the things that set him apart. And so we wanted to duplicate that with Katagiri. So we looked high and low to find things that met the period. And we found the one, but then because there was a possibility that it might get damaged, because cars that old in Japan often are not maintained well enough, so there's always a possibility it might not start. So we had to find a second one for season two. And we found one that was slightly different and in a different color. And we did the modifications to make it match. And being able to match that color of red, that was one of the hardest things we had to do.
That's a big get, Ken Watanabe. Talk about making that happen.
Ansel came on board first, very early. And then we reached out to Ken. And Ken loves to work on international projects. And he just took to the role immediately. He read the pilot and he fell in love with Katagiri. He's still in love with Katagiri. And first of all, he's one of the greatest actors I've ever worked with, but he also is a great man. When Ken-san is on set, nobody would ever dare step out of line, although he himself never shows any anger or irritation. He's just always calm and cool because he knows he's setting the example. And even as a director, he's incredibly easy to work with. He comes to set with tons of ideas. Most of his ideas are really good because he's really thought through the character and also knows a lot about police behavior. But when you as a director say, yes, that's a great idea, that's great. And when you say, no, I don't think that works for the character in this moment because of this and that, he'd be like, okay, forget it. He doesn't dig in. And he is a consummate professional. And it's almost like we couldn't have made the show as smoothly as we did without his presence.
But we can't talk about this sort of ad hoc family around Jake without talking about his editor, who's also kind of a big sister figure. He sort of takes advantage of her ambition and getting Rinko for that part, too. I mean, that's a big, or at least it felt to me like a big get.
Yes, it was. But it's also worth mentioning that with the exception of Sho Kasamatsu, who plays Sato, who's big now but was relatively unknown when we cast him, with the exception of Sho, all of our Japanese characters, they're already big stars there. It's just we know Ken and we know Rinko because they've been in a lot of international productions. But like,
if you know Japanese film, you know all these actors.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why casting was so exciting. And like getting Yosuke Kubozuka to play Hayama, Sato's nemesis in season two, he's a huge star. And also an amazing actor.
Was the show that big a magnet for casting people based on getting
it was a big,
Ken in the first
season
place?
Season one, based on the fact that it was a big international show that was going to shoot in Tokyo, so that the actors didn't have to live abroad for a long time, and also that it was going to have exposure around the world, it was a draw, even from season one onward. In season two, because the show now had been well-received in Japan, it became a bigger draw. So even in casting Nagata, the female deputy superintendent who comes in over Katagiri, that's Miki Maya, who is amazing in the part. But she was a huge star in the Takarazuka. Do you know the Takarazuka? Do I have to explain? I should explain.
Yes, please.
Takarazuka is a musical theater troupe in Japan that is hugely popular. There are these wild kind of Baroque musical extravaganzas.
Kind of Baroque?
I'm a fan. I'm speaking as a fan.
I am too. No. But they're totally Baroque.
But all the roles are played by women. So in some ways, it is kind of the kind of distaff response to Kabuki, where all the roles are played by men, except that Takarazuka is modern. It was developed in the post-war period.
And comes with a sense of irony.
I think we imbue a sense of irony.
Do we? Am I missing the point here?
No, it's from, let's put it this way. If it's camp, it's because it's true camp, because it's never intentionally camp.
Okay, yeah.
They are giving, and you know, one of the hardest things to do as a young Japanese girl is to pass the entrance exam to get into Takarazuka, because you have to do years and years of training, and they start in high school, and they have thousands and thousands of girls apply for like 100 entrants each year. As in Kabuki, where the biggest stars are the onnagata, the men who play the female roles, the big stars that come out of Takarazuka are the women who play the male roles. And Miki-san was one of those. She was a big, you know, she played the male roles in Takarazuka. She was a huge heartthrob. But you can see that. And also, she's a dancer. And so you can see what she brings to the role in terms of her physicality and in terms of her being able to be casually authoritative is, I don't know another actor who could have done that.
It is this amalgam of melodrama, almost like austere Japanese melodrama, and American genre show. They feel like two things to me that when you told me you were doing it, I said, okay. Because I don't really see it. Because also, having had the experience of reading the book, the world looked different to me. And to see these elements knit together, actually, they actually sort of balance each other. Was that a hard thing to pull off? Because we really feel how successful it is, starting with that first shot in the first scene of the second season. It feels like the show just took off to me. Was it hard to realize, and did it take time to get there?
It took a season.
Did it really?
Okay. I mean, I think that this is pretty common to my experience, that if you have the fortune to be on a show that continues It's really season two where you can really find yourself, because you've learned the lessons, you've made the mistakes, you've honed the working relationships, both with cast and among the creatives, and you can really play to your strengths. And I feel like with JT and me, it was definitely that way, that coming in, we knew exactly how to plan, and we knew how to chart a longer trajectory, and knew how to make the show better and put our resources on screen. But the other factor in that is that season one, we were kind of pariahs in Tokyo. We were a bunch of gaijin, you know, foreigners, coming in to make a show about the Yakuza, of all things. And so the assumption, and a fair assumption on the Japanese side, was, well, they're going to get everything wrong, because that's what history would tell them. So there was skepticism, and we were shooting in the middle of the pandemic. We shot 6 days of the pilot with Michael Mann and then got shut down for 7 months and then went back to prep and reshoot the pilot. And even then, Japan was under much more stringent restrictions than
you could
the
barely
US
get in or out of.
We couldn't get anybody in. But season two, sea change, the pandemic had lightened up enough. Japan still, there were still more cautions on the Japanese side. We did antigen tests every day. Everybody did. You know, we were still masked on set. But the city was open. The city was alive, and people did not immediately think we were going to bring strange germs into their locations. But then, even more importantly, the show, season one, had been a hit, and they had seen that we had basically gotten it right, and that they could trust us to present, you know, a fair image of all these different worlds. And so the city opened up. So we went from being pariahs to being VIPs. And that just opened up so many doors in terms of what we were able to shoot on location. We created a very strong relationship with the governor of Tokyo, Yuriko Koike, who I've officially been designated as a tourism ambassador for the city of Tokyo. And they had receptions for us. And so it was really, I mean,
That's a different reception.
And so some of the sequences in season two, this, I'm now speaking like action, but the traffic jam where one of the assassins is assassinated.
That's a really great sequence.
Could never have done that season one. We shut down a 4-lane street for an entire day. The scene, the big scene, the crime aftermath in episode 6 outside of Sam's Club, where you have all the police cordon and Jake comes in on his bike and talks to Katagiri. That's in the on one of the major nightlife streets in Akasaka, which is a very high-end hostess club area. Never would have been able to do that. That's from our experience of season one, and also from having changed our status in Japan, we were really able to accomplish so much more.
Well, I guess it's true. It's always good to have a hit. I guess I will prove that. The second season, hoping for a third, I'm hoping for a third of Tokyo Vice on Max. You can also hear the show if you want at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Alan, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis. As always, it's been a pleasure.
An action show as well as a cross-cultural and cross-generational melodrama, Tokyo Vice is finishing its second season on Max. Executive producer Alan Poole spoke about its season finale, which drops on Max on April 4th. Stories that span generations and their storytellers can be heard at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreatment. Interviews that span over the course of an hour. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We've seen all kinds of documentaries rise and proliferate and flower over the last 20 years, but I think we've forgotten there's a tradition of documentaries such as the films by Emile D'Antonio or Jerry Bruck, who did the terrific IF Stones Weekly. Documentaries that are kind of meant to ask questions about the roots of power in this country. And there's a terrific new film by an old friend who's doing this show for the first time, now director, Stephen Yalaki. His film, his documentary, is beautifully titled Bad Faith. First of all, Steve, it's so good to have you sitting here across from me. And I do feel that this film fits into that kind of film. I was finding myself thinking of Points of Order and The Year of the Pig as I was watching it.
Absolutely. I mean, it was films, political films, and those some of the things that turned me on that made me want to make films. Watching political films like The Battle of Algiers, films that were actually attempting to show that you didn't really know what was going on. There was more happening than the mainstream media was filling you in on. And I thought that should be one of the primary goals of film, to shed light where light is not being shed.
If you could explain to the audience what Bad Faith is about and why that title is so appropriate.
Okay. Bad Faith, the title, refers to not only the kind of faith that they're proclaiming is a complete, according to Russell Moore, a heresy as far as Christianity is concerned. It has nothing to do with Christianity. So it's bad faith in that respect. It's also bad faith is because they don't believe it. The leaders don't believe it. They are acting in bad faith. They have an ulterior motive, and they're exploiting Christianity and the symbols of Christianity in order to accomplish their political and economic goals. So they are operating in bad faith.
And we should say you start work on this before January 6th, 2020.
Oh, yeah. I started on this in 2018. And mostly the reason I started it was to try to understand how Trump won. When Trump won with massive support of the evangelicals, I wanted to know more about the evangelicals. And I didn't get a lot of luck getting the conservative evangelicals. People like Franklin Graham wouldn't talk to me. But I eventually got, let's call it progressive evangelicals like Reverend Barber and other people.
Jonathan Wilson Hargrove.
Exactly.
Yes.
Jonathan Wilson Hargrove. And eventually conservatives like Russell Moore to talk because they were.
Elizabeth Newman. It was shocking to me to see her in this film.
I mean, you had those people who were like, who got into the Trump administration because of the fact that they have those connections among the conservative evangelicals, you know, and somebody didn't go along with it. She was like pretty horrified with what happened.
No, we should say she was a part of the administration, part of the Department of Homeland Security, and even she was appalled by what happened on January 6th.
Oh, yeah. She is an example of somebody who we wanted to show it's not just progressive evangelicals, but it's evangelicals who remain connected to the gospel of Jesus. And again, this was for me personally, I was raised a Catholic. So even though I, you know, ended up not being a part of the church anymore, I always had a good feeling about Jesus. I can't blame Jesus for what the church became, right? Jesus's teachings were pretty solid. And even when I was dean, I had the Jesuits had a thing called the discernment, and they had a thing to kind of teach you about. I mean, it sounds funny, I know, but actually, it was almost like having a religious instruction. Again, at my age, you know, I went through this thing with a priest who's a good friend of mine about what I didn't like about the church, and he said, "Forget that stuff." He said, "Just think, what do you like? Let's focus on what you like." But anyway, so the Jesus thing to me was something that was kind of a touchstone. Obviously, when I first started out naively, I thought, gee, if people realized what Jesus was saying, they wouldn't believe that stuff. But then I realized they don't teach the gospel. They've erased the actual gospels from their teaching, these mega churches. It's inconvenient what he actually said. And this is what, you know, Barber points out. He says, you know, they may have the Trump, but they don't have Jesus. I'm kind of particular about the Jesus.
By the way, it's the truth. My guest, who seems to be apparently talking about Vatican III, is Steve Yalaki. He's the writer and director of the terrific documentary Bad Faith. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But you talk about what they teach. What's fascinating to me is these things that are really simplistic that have become part of the firmament for this movement. Like this idea that there is no separation of church and state in the Constitution.
Yeah.
And you have Lauren Boebert saying that it's just in some letters somewhere. No, it's not just in some letters somewhere. It's part of what this country is. There's so much of this mythology that this movement has subscribed to, and it's been repeated so often that it's now regarded as fact.
Absolutely. They have their own, quote, historians, end quote, who go on, who are on lecture tour, who have books, and who are constantly making that point that there was no separation of church and state. But in fact, the scholars who are legitimate scholars point out how that was absolutely what the founders had in mind. They had the experience of Europe.
And, England, and the Church of England, and the imposition.
That's what they were revolting against. That's what they did not want to reproduce. And the Baptists, as Russell Moore says, even before the founding of the country, the Baptists very strongly wanted separation of church and state because they had been the ones who had been most attacked by the establishment. So it's a complete reversal.
I guess what I find so fascinating about the film is just, again, for me, it's the way the research sort of led to you to find out how far back this goes. And it's easier for us to think of this as being this kind of momentary aberration. Mm-hmm. But as even is said in the last third of the film, January 16th have sneaked up on the country. But if you were paying attention, the seeds were always being planted and had been planted for decades before that.
Absolutely, Elvis. The thing, it was like a crime going on in plain sight. It was, and I think it's because people did not think that these people were serious. They didn't even hear what was going on the East and West Coast. It was a closed community that was passing this learning on about the primacy of God over democracy, over the, that democracy was even stood in the way of the path to Jesus and God's kingdom. This was something that they believed very firmly. And it was passed on over the years by millions and millions of people. I never had heard of it. And I think most Americans not in that culture would have heard about this. And yet it was completely insurrection. It was the insurrection in the making that was taking place, And they were totally on message. They never changed the message. They said, the guy says at the outset of the film, government, when it's not in the hands of godly people, is evil. Evil? Okay, but that's part of their religious belief, which is they've then brought into the political sphere. Because in their belief system, it's very clear cut. There's Jesus and there's the devil. You're either with Jesus or you're with the devil. The leaders, in order to get their followers to vote Republican, made it very simple. The Republicans are the party of God. The Democrats are the party of the devil. And to this day, that's now an article of faith amongst all these people. And it was just simply a device they used to get them to vote the way they wanted them to vote so that the leaders could get the power that they sought so they could turn around the Supreme Court and they could manage to kind of turn the clock back to before the 60s ever happened when progress was being made on civil rights, women, gays. They wanted all that gone. And that's what their goal is.
So the question I want to ask you, and you should say the name of the company is Heretical Reason Production, so it doesn't, it starts the ground floor for you. But what did this make you talking before about talking to a priest, what did this make you come to reconcile your questions about faith and your issues with it? Because you have William Barber, who is this beacon, talking about how religion should not be used, faith should not be used as something to divide us. It's incredible to hear somebody who's that reasoned, who's that thoughtful, who's that powerful, sounding like the odd person out, given the way I was raised and what I heard said around my house. He sounds like every preacher I ever saw as a kid. So to see him being, it seemed like he's, again, the unusual person. I wonder if this made you ask yourself about your relationship to faith.
The way I connected to the progressive evangelicals like Reverend Barber was because he reminded me of the social justice Catholics, Father Berrigan, Jesuits in the 60s, and the liberation theology and the priests and the faith leaders who in the 60s were very much on the side of the advancement of civil rights, women's rights. And so people like Reverend Barber and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and Jim Wallace, who has only a small part in it, although he co-founded the Sojourners, which was a very important organization. I connected with them because that was my understanding of it. That was a good interpretation of what Jesus was all about. And so that's how I felt connected to Reverend Barber and to the evangelicals. And evangelicals, there's all kinds of evangelicals, I realize. It's not you can't paint them all with one brush. Unfortunately, and this is a problem that a lot of the progressive evangelical leaders have, the bad faith evangelicals have made evangelicals lose credibility amongst even their young people who are leaving the churches in droves, because the church has become so politicized that they no longer want any part of it. It no longer provides any kind of spiritual solace to them. It's giving them political instruction.
There was a time when the religious movement was about asking questions about this kind of orthodoxy of conservatism. When it was SNCC, when it was Dr. King, when it was the Berrigans, when it was people of faith from all different disciplines who came together and said, no, this bad faith from conservatism is what's leading this country to down the wrong path.
Yeah.
And there was this groundswell of religious groups that banded together and fought for civil rights and fought for recognition of what we're doing in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And fought for, even inside the Catholic Church, to give women power. And so now that it's become this thing that has become so reductive, I just found that making a movie about that, it's got to be a fascinating thing to do, because I was fascinated in watching. Oh, geez, there's a constancy of this contraction of thought that's now considered to be part of what evangelism is, and that damages that very word. And that's what fascinates me about the film.
The thing that's remarkable to me is that a person like Reverend Barber, who is the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, which is an attempt to continue the work of Martin Luther King, who in the 60s led campaigns that involved economic and political progress. I mean, he was not just Americans don't have a full understanding of what Martin Luther King was going for.
He was a part of the labor movement.
Absolutely.
He got the garbage men together. That's what the March on Washington was
Absolutely.
About, which people tend to forget.
Absolutely. And Reverend Barber, what he's trying to do is exactly the same thing that Martin Luther King was doing, except 40 years later, the religious right and the extremists have been so successful, it makes him seem like he's radical.
One thing that occurs to me, that these bricks are falling out of the wall brick by brick.
Yeah.
We just had last week Mike Pence say, after saying before he didn't know whether he were elected, if he would pardon Trump, him now saying he can't go along with this.
Yeah.
A clip of him in your film,
where
he talks about this can't just be a moment where they build a next generation of people like this. So he's not without the ability to be calculating, that he's been shaken out of that mindset and can see what's going on around him.
Mm-hmm.
Do moments like that give you faith? Because certainly compiling this film could be the opposite of an article of faith. But do beats like that, Mike Pence standing up and saying, for the second time in 4 years, after refusing to certify the election on the behalf of Trump, him saying what he said, does that give you hope? Does that give you, because certainly hearing Barber talk gives me hope in the film.
Well, I'll tell you, the problem is this. You've got somebody running for president who has violated his constitutional oath in the first place. The first time in the history of the country that somebody has not peacefully allowed the transfer of power. How that person can even be allowed to run again is one of the real failings in our American democracy, because he should be categorically disqualified. And it only shows that democracy is very unable to defend itself against attacks, especially attacks from within, which is what happened when they took over the Republican Party and were able to attack it from within. And the other thing about, there's a theory of revolution, and I studied this in college. Revolutions start with some people being more moderate in terms of what they want, but there is an inevitable movement toward the more radical, more radical, more radical, until it ends up with a despot, you know, with a Napoleon or with a Lenin, you know.
Or Putin.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got a situation now where somebody like Pence, you know, who was totally one of theirs. He was part of this Council for National Policy, which we don't have time to get into now, but that's like the smoking gun of the film, when you discovered that they were planning to destroy the democratic institutions because they were never going to win majority rule. But a guy like Pence hadn't really thought through where this was all going, even though he kind of believed in the Christian mission. You know, so there's that going on. But then you've got the extremists who are able to use it, and then they end up with a guy like Trump, who basically was created by Christian nationalism. He wouldn't have had a chance without that buildup of a grievance about Obama. He was the white answer to Obama.
And he was attacking Obama even before he let himself be co-opted and join that part of it.
He was showing his credentials to them with the birtherism thing. He was saying, hey, here I am. You should think of me. I'm a guy who can actually, I can say outright what you're maybe thinking, but don't want to say. And that's what he ended up doing.
My guest is Stephen Ulaki, an old friend who I'm glad we got to do this show, who clearly has made a film that offers a lot. And there's a lot to talk about, which we can't get into here, but I would urge you to see the film Bad Faith. Steve, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
The documentary Bad Faith just began its run at the Lemley Monica on March 29th. It plays there for a week and then to New York Cinema Village starting April 4th. Its director is Stephen Ulaki. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat for award-winning actor Taraji P. Henson, who's brought her musical theater training to the film musical The Color Purple, in which she played Shug Avery. She recollects a vision of songs and silks on a yellow brick road.
Hi, I'm Taraji P. Henson, and this is The Treat. My aunt and my godmother, who, when my mother couldn't afford to put me in extracurricular activities, noticed that I was a special child. So they enrolled me at the Kennedy Center. I had this acting program for the youth. And so I did the program there, and that's when I started to, you know, really get into this is what I like. You know, the acting started getting into my body. But then they took me to see The Wiz on Broadway. And I don't think I blinked the entire time. I was like, that is what I want to do. And for me, yes, it was that on the stage and the grandness and the beautiful, the spectacle, the lights and all of that. But it was the emotion that was in the audience, like, I was like, I want to make people feel like that. This feeling that I have, I want to make little girls and little boys feel this feeling that I have. That's where it took off from there. And all those little moments, maybe that's why I was the class clown, because I was chasing that feeling.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home, I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing.
Because I was an only child, my imagination, I was very creative in my imagining. I had to, because I was playing alone. My father said as young as 2 and 4, he'd be watching the game. My parents split when I was really young. And whenever I would have to go with him, I didn't have all my toys there. So I had to go to imagining, and he said he'd be watching a game and I would make him get all on all fours, and he didn't know. He's just doing what I asked him to do. He's watching the game, and all of a sudden he hears, shh, shh, and I'm washing dishes and frying. I have no dishes or anything. All of this is my imagination and my dad's back. I did a summer program where I taught acting to at-risk youth. And I remember we didn't have money for costumes. So I went to Howard University to Reggie Ray, may he rest in peace, who's head of the costume department. And I was like, where's your scrap material? They gave me 2 trash bags of scrap material. And these babies, they just wanted to feel like a real play was happening. And I made, stitched little stuff together. And I took these sheets and I cut them and I stitched them together. We didn't know it was art. And so the storm was coming and I had those babies because of what I saw when I witnessed, you know, The Wiz all those years ago. That stuck with me.
Everybody look around, because there's a reason to rejoice, you see. Everybody come out and let's commence to sing in joyfully. Everybody look up.
Star of Empire, Hustle and Flow, and the musical The Color Purple, Taraji P. Henson, on another musical adaptation, The Wiz. Actor Daniel Day Kim on a musical that showed him inclusion and variety. With other treats, it's at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreat. Stories that involve music, that include the craft of film and stage, that extend to the worlds of books and style. Stories that captivate and cultivate inspiration. They're the treat. And this story is easing on down the road to its end. Produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help getting us here from Laura Kondarajan, Phil Richards, and Sue Margulies. I'm not The Wiz, and to better days, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's the treat.